Hey, it's Bill Simmons. Thanks for checking out this feed of my favorite interviews and best guests over the last 7 years. Whether it's your first time or you're already in a deep dive, make sure you head to BillSimmonsInterviews.TheRinger.com for the entire archive. You can sort by genre, year, and more to easily navigate all your favorite people. Again, that is BillSimmonsInterviews.TheRinger.com. Enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. All right, Matt Damon is here. We're taking this on a Monday, running it later in the week. So who knows? Who knows what will happen over the next 3 days in sports and life? Let's talk sports first, because last time you came on, we went movies deep, and then late, I felt like we did the sports at the tail end.
We did.
Red Sox? Yankees, yeah. How we feeling?
Okay, so, well, first of all, I got to qualify all this. I have never been less connected to the sports world than I am right now. I just got back from Australia, and then I went to France to debut this movie, and then came. So I've been following, I'm looking at the box scores. And the other thing I kind of hold you mildly responsible for is when the last time we talked, we had a whole thing. It wasn't clear what was going to happen with Mookie. And you said, it really stuck with me because you were articulating how I felt. You said something great, which was, I've planned to watch this guy. Like, I've made plans to watch this guy for like the next 15 years. Like, this is a thing that I've been counting on. Like, you can't take that away from me. Like, we actually have the once in a generation talent. Like, we got him. He's ours. You can't possibly take this away from us. And I was so pissed off when we lost him.
Yeah.
That I'd obviously never break up with the Red Sox, but like, you know, I was happy to be in Marseille making this movie and just be away from it for that seat. Like, I was just like, and then the pandemic hit and, you know, and so I'm out of it. I'm following in the box scores. I know we're great. I know we're doing great. And I think we're going to win our division. I mean, I know it's very early, so, but I'm still reeling from the Mookie thing. I got to tell you,
I had the same thing.
Really, fucking hurt.
I stopped following them last year. It was the first Red Sox season that basically took off. I knew it was going to come back.
Yeah. You did too.
I did.
All right. Okay. I don't feel so bad then.
Well, it was pandemic season. It was 60 games. They were clearly tanking. And it just seemed like it's like both of us are married to the Red Sox that's going to be our one way for our whole life. But this was definitely the, I'm going to move out of the house and get an apartment. And I don't know if I'm coming back or not moment.
I think we need some time apart.
Right. Just a couple months.
Just a couple months. Like, it was a legit separation.
Yeah. Well, the way you weren't in LA when Mookie was kicking ass for the Dodgers, and all the Dodgers fans were like, I can't believe we get this guy. How'd you give him up? And I'm like, I know.
When I turned 50 last year, my good friend Sam Jones was nice enough to record Mookie, you know, sending me a personal message, because of course he wears number 50, and it was all about how 50 is such a great number. And I was like, oh, fuck you, man. We're going to have to forgive the Red Sox and move on. Right.
I've got there.
That's because you have to get past it on your own. You know what I mean? There's no, you have to find it in your heart to let it go, because the violation is just too great. It's like, you have to come to your own peace with it somehow.
Well, they had the fourth pick in the minor league draft. They drafted this high school shortstop, Marcelo Mayer from San Diego, who was supposed to go first, and it was super exciting. And my guard was like 10% up. It's like, all right, so we're going to have this guy. Right. I'm going to feel like he's going to be part of my life until I'm in my 70s. And then you guys are just going to trade him when he's 28. Is that how this is going to play out again? But you know these guys, you know the owners though. Like, would it ever be a situation where you would text or email John Henry and be like, what the fuck? What are you doing?
Man. No. Well, but listen, remember in 04, that Nomar move seemed to be so insane. And yet we all, like, there was this deference to Theo, and we all just went, oh, hang on a minute. Like, let the kid do what he's got to do. What I mean? And obviously that, you can't argue with the results they've had. It's just that Mookie himself was just so insanely likable. He just seemed like the guy, you know what I mean? It was like, he's the guy, and we got the guy. You know what I mean? I still love everything about the guy's game. Of course he went and won a World Series. That's what he does.
Well, and also what he could have meant to the city too. I think the Celtics are in the same spot with Tatum and Brown right now. And Brown, I don't think they're trading Brown, but Brown gets just thrown into trade rumors every time Dame Lillard or Ben Simmons, I'm like, I don't want to trade Jaylen Brown. The guy loves the city. He's going to do like a lot of good stuff off the court. Plus, he's really good on the court. Why do we have to trade him?
Yeah, why do we even talk about it? I hope those are just rumors.
I think they are.
Why would you mess with those guys? I mean, they're amazing.
Well, what about your guy Brady? Because the last time you were on, I think he was still a Pat, and now he goes to the Bucks. I know you're filming movies and stuff, but I know you were following this and watching.
I watched every Bucks game last year.
So you jumped on the bandwagon?
It's not even a bandwagon. I love Tom. I love him. He's a once in a lifetime athlete for all of us who were lucky enough to be able to follow his entire career. I'm riding it all the way to the end. It's not a bandwagon. I'm all in on that guy. I'm following Tommy. Like, I want to see. I'm just so, the fact that he did that last year on a torn MCL. I mean, I just stop it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just awesome. It's such a great story. I was always a believer, everybody does was it Belichick or was it Brady? Belichick's an amazing coach, but I never doubted that it wasn't Brady.
You thought the seesaw was tilted more toward Brady?
Yes.
In that.
Yeah, because he's on the field playing the game.
Yeah. I was hurt. I was hurt that he left. I felt like he ditched us a tiny bit. No, I got over it. I got over it by halfway through the season.
They could have kept him.
They could have. That's why. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I don't begrudge that guy anything. I actually want him to go. I want him to go win another Super Bowl. I think that would be, it's just such an awesome story.
Did you think that he was hanging on too long? Was there any part of you that was like, oh, this is, you're pushing a little bit, buddy?
Do you look at the guy's arm? Like, he looks like a 30-year-old out there. Like, there's no part of like, I never understood that Max Kellerman thing. I mean, I guess Kellerman was kind of doing the actuary tables, was kind of how he described it, because, there really is that fall off a cliff moment for athletes at that level. But Brady showed no, he was making every throw. He still is, like, and never with the collection of wide receivers that other quarterbacks had. I mean, 07, they gave him, when Welker showed up and Moss, you were like, oh my God. And I mean, the dude literally almost went 19-0.
You're starting to scare me. You weren't like wearing a Bucks hat, were you? Like, how far did this go?
No.
I felt like this was like full-fledged sports bigamy going on here.
No. I'm just rooting for him, man. I'm just rooting for him.
Do you talk to him? You have a relationship with him?
Occasionally, every once in a while, I'll send him a text and stuff. We did a bit for Kimmel a couple years ago, but we're not in the same town a lot. Ben bumped into him last year, before last season, before he decided which team he was going to. But no, we'll see him sporadically.
He seems relentlessly positive, like a relentlessly positive person to have in your life.
He's just the nicest guy. Like, he's as nice as he seems in those. I mean, he's just a relentlessly positive guy. I mean, it just, you know, I mean, maybe it's when you've created this like this virtuous cycle of like goodness, everything goes right in your life and it's easy to keep
right.
You know what I mean? And it just keeps going and you're like, damn, every time you walk away, you're like, God, that guy really is that nice. He's the guy you root for.
I am worried about, you know, we had a nice run with the Boston teams. And that now that's 2020s. Now we're 1 year in, we haven't won a title. I'm starting to get itchy. It's been like a year and a half.
The Sox look good. The Celtics are right there. Patriots, it's going to be a while, I think. If you ask me, that's my.
Depends if the rookie QB can be good right away. Because I think the rest of the team's really good.
The rookie QB is good. And like, are they going to? Yeah. I mean, you know, our defense will show up. But, you know, you got to spend some of your resources on people to throw the ball to.
True. Well, maybe you should text the rookie QB and tell him you're in his corner. Maybe he needs a confidence boost. Maybe you and Ben should both text him.
Hey, listen, we'll be all for that guy. I mean, he's got to go get the job, right? Because it's him and Cam. They haven't figured out who's going to be.
Yeah, I think they're going to sacrifice Cam for a few weeks and then bring the rookie in once really? They get to Cam's an easy part great, of the though. Schedule.
I love Cam. I love his game. He's a great dude too. I definitely pull for that guy.
I'd like to see him complete passes that are more than 8 yards. So if he can do that, maybe he keeps the job. Last year, he was bouncing passes all over the place.
Last year, Brady was there. Didn't they do a stat that we had the worst separation of any? I mean, you look
wasn't
at the
great.
Yeah. I mean, you're throwing into toaster ovens every time. Like, that's really hard to do.
You know, school ties was on. You were like, I don't know what kind of running back you were in that movie. It was more like, were you three down good. Back in that movie? What were you supposed to be? Were you like a LaDainian Tomlinson or more like a Darren Sproles type?
We ran out of the wing tee, you know, it was a little different kind of running. That's 30 years ago now, I realized. Over 30 years ago, we made that movie.
Is that true? So you've been making movies for 30 years, though?
Yeah. Yeah. I turned 21 on School Ties. So I'm 50 now. I'll be 51 in October.
We went back and did a lot of your movies the last time you were on. We did for the rewatchables this week, we did Fight Club because...
Great.
So, but there's this whole vortex where it's like you and Ed Norton and who are the other guys you were fighting for movies with at the time? There's one, and there's one other one because it was like Fight Club, Talented Mr. Ripley. And then there was a third movie and everybody was jockeying and it became like this merry-go-round where it ended up being you did Talented Mr. Ripley. Ed Norton was going for that. He ended up doing Fight Club. And then somebody else who was supposed to go to Fight Club went to another movie.
Edward was up for Talented Mr. Ripley. He was up for Rainmaker, I remember. And then by the time we did Rounders, he was telling me about Fight Club. He was the first person to tell me. So he was already attached to it. And I remember walking through New York with him and he talked about it for like 45 minutes. And I was like, this is going to be the most amazing movie. And it was. I mean, you know, David Fincher, like what a director.
It's such a fun time for movies, that mid to late 90s stretch. You have so many young filmmakers coming in. You have your whole generation of actors. And
yeah, man, that was it. Like I was talking to Ben about that recently. Like, I wonder how we would have felt about movies if we were that age and, you know, if we were coming kind of age in the business as it is now, because it's just so different. Like, it's just completely different. All those movies that we love that were kind of our bread and butter and were the movies we wanted to go see, even if we weren't in them, are the ones that don't get made anymore, or it's very hard to get them made. So I wonder if I would have, I feel like I still would have wanted to make movies. I've never really wanted to do anything else, but it's just a very, very different business.
Well, it seems like there would have been a pressure on you to do, I don't know, like your fourth movie ever would have been like some superhero movie where you're trying to get into the quick of like the six superheroes. You're like the fifth guy in the billing and that will catapult you to something else.
Yeah, right. That seems to be the way forward now for You know, and then I get it. I mean, it's steady work. It's like, it's kind of what I had with that, the Bourne series. You know, I was kind of inoculated from business strategizing, right? Because I always knew I had another Bourne movie. So I could kind of do whatever I wanted. Like, I'll take a shot with this movie or that movie. And, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. Like if, you know, which I think is actually the best way to approach this business. Just like see who's directing the movie, you know, see if it's a story you want to be a part of telling, and then just go do it. And on balance, you're going to have like, you're going to make more good movies than bad, and you're going to survive versus like the kind of, well, I need to do a quote unquote big movie now, or this has a big budget, or the IP on this movie is really, you know, it's a great graphic novel or whatever people think. I've never found that way of approaching the business to be any more, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm saying people who think they have this business figured out, there's the great quote of William Goldman, which is nobody knows anything.
Right.
And I really find that to be true. And so if you really want to do this and survive, it's really about, making the movies that you want, that you think are good, not that you think other people are going to go see.
Well, you do the one for me, one for them strategy, basically.
Not really. I mean, that was something we talked about in the 90s, but I've never really done one for them. You know, every movie I've made, I've wanted to do it, and I've wanted to, you know, some are bigger than others, but I didn't kind of approach it with, oh, this is a movie that I'm going to hate.
How about one for the wallet and then one for me?
Look, I was lucky. Like, that's another part of the business that is different, right? We get paid a lot more. There was way more money in the movie business.
That's true.
In between 2000 and say 2010, it was a totally different business. And we lost the DVD. And so that kind of cut the business in half.
Well, now it seems like it's changing again, because now if these movies are premiering on the streaming services, and also in the theater, then how do you figure out the back end? It always seems like there's some new wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix was paying a lot of money up front, I think. They were kind of saying, we'll give you, I haven't done a movie at Netflix, but it looked like they were kind of buying you out up front.
Yeah, they overpay for it, yeah.
Right, right. But, you know, back in the day, those are like, you know, the Tom Cruises of the world and Bruce Willis, and those deals those guys were making were like, you know, you got a huge boatload of cash up front, and then you got 20% of the movie no matter what. So, you know, I mean, it's a lot of money.
We did a podcast on Terminator 2 on the rewatchables, and one of the things Schwarzenegger got, they literally just gave him a plane. As part of, yeah, he got a jet as part of his salary, sure. On top of like all the other shit.
I'll give you a plane.
Yeah,
I'll tell you,
it doesn't have to be a new one. If you used one, it's fine.
Sure. Well, he's reasonable, you know.
So he had like points, he had the salary, and then he got a jet.
And then they just gave him a plane. Yeah.
By the way,
yeah,
great deal. That movie made like $400 million or something. So that was probably worth it.
Yeah, by the way, they were happy to do it, I'm sure. Like, you know, that movie was amazing, and you can't make it without him. So
you haven't really dove into the whole streaming TV universe or like the HBO prestige show, anything like that. Have you ever thought about doing that?
Yeah. I mean, if the right thing comes along, it's really just about what they're making and, you know, is it, I mean, I feel like a lot of the really good stuff is migrating that way.
Yeah.
So it's probably, you know, it's probably a matter of time till, you know, I do something. I just haven't found something I want to do yet.
Like Big Little Lies season 4, it's in Nantucket. You've got some sort of drinking problem.
Right, exactly.
Yelling at people who think you're better than me.
Exactly.
All right, we'll throw your hat in the ring for that. So you're still doing the thing where you gravitate toward the good filmmakers, and McCarthy's been, I think, one of the most original guys the last 10 years. So what pulls you into this one?
That was
Stillwater.
Yeah, Stillwater. I'd been dying to work with him, and I read the script. I just thought it was great. It looks like it's going to be one thing, and then it's something else entirely. And I really like that. And I just believe, you know, it's about a really specific thing, which is a roughneck from Oklahoma, and you know, even within the context of Oklahoma, like somebody works out in those oil fields and does that, is it's a very specific guy. And so it was a great role that, you know, a great role that I got to play. And then, and you transplant that guy to a place like Marseille, which is a very, very specific city in France. It's not Paris, it's Marseille. It's its own thing. And that guy, like, trying to blunder his way around Marseille, I thought was a really interesting, you know, to help his daughter, I thought was a really interesting movie.
I like how he approached it, where he got a French screenwriter to help him.
Yeah.
Like, realize that, all right, I can't just Wikipedia different parts of this and patch it together. I should actually get somebody who understands how this whole world works.
Yeah, Tom's obviously one of our best screenwriters in America. And then he went to two of the best screenwriters in France, and they partnered and they wrote together. And it's really, that's what kind of makes it special.
How much weight did you put on?
I don't know. I just,
because Kimmel was calling you Fat Damon. I don't know if you heard any of those. Those bars. He's like, yeah. It's like, did you see Matt lately? He's Fat Damon now.
Of course he was. But those guys all going down there, they all, that job is really physically tough.
Yeah.
You know, you got to lift a lot of heavy shit. They're very strong, strong guys.
So you have to be like husky Matt Damon.
Yeah, but they don't have six pack abs. I mean the guys my age don't. Some of the young guys, like, they know all about CrossFit and they're like workout guys, and they do look like that. But my generation, all, you know, they're beefy, strong dudes. And so I was just trying to get that body type. So I just changed my diet, and then I lifted really heavy weights and didn't do any cardio, because that's kind of their, there's a lot of heavy stuff that those guys got to lift. And it's an incredibly hard job. Like, there's no way I could do it. I was on an oil rig for 15 minutes and I was like, absolutely no way.
Yeah, you kind of looked like a old, like, ex-right tackle who played semi-pro. Right. You had like one of those kind of bodies.
Right. That's exactly right. So it was more, so I didn't weigh myself as much as just look in the mirror and kind of look at what was looking back at me and try to make it feel right. And that whole look, that goatee and the wraparound glasses and the hat and all that stuff is very specific. Like, our wardrobe supervisor was talking directly to these roughnecks. And so the jeans I wear, they'll have like fire retardant on them. And they, you know, it's like the very specific, you know, every little detail was kind of came from them.
Did you grow the facial hair yourself?
No, that's a hand laid beard and that's a trick that only the Italians know, believe it or not.
Really?
Passed down through as like a trade secret from, in my case, the guy who did mine, from his father. It's a very closely guarded secret that the Italians specialize in. The first time I ever saw it was in 93 on a movie called Geronimo that I was doing with, and Robert Duvall was in it. And Duvall had this, this great old makeup artist who's now passed away. His name was Manlio. And Manlio, I watched him hand lay a beard on Bobby Duvall, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it's like you could be, you know, like right up in his grill and not know. I mean, it's really something to watch him do it.
Did this movie break the record for most career body transformation roles? Because I feel like this is at least five. Courage Under Fire, you were like, what were you, like 130 pounds? Like, you almost died.
That was bad, right? I definitely screwed my system up. Like, I was on medication for about a year or year and a half after that, just to try to re-regulate my system.
What kind of medication? Like blood pressure stuff?
I screwed my adrenal glands. I was, I got depressed. I got anxiety. Like, basically, the way the doctor explained it to me was I tricked my system into thinking a bear was chasing me for like 4 months.
Oh, God.
Because all I was doing was like not eating enough and running, because I didn't have a trainer. I couldn't afford one. So I just kind of, I talked to this guy was a friend of ours at the time, who was actually an Austrian bodybuilder, who actually sounded a lot like Schwarzenegger when he talked. And this guy gave me his bodybuilding routine that he would do 3 weeks out from a show. And that's a really, really hardcore routine. But I did it for like, I don't know, 14 or 16 weeks. And
And I didn't see him. I saw him at the end and he was like, you did that for 16. He's like, you can't do that. Like, I didn't think you would do that. And I was like, well, that's what you told me to do. And it was basically just not taking in enough calories and then just running, you know, 13 miles a day. It was 6.5 miles in the morning and 6.5 at night.
Oh my God.
I'd wake up and I'd run and then I'd not eat enough. And then at the end of the day, I'd go run and then I'd go to bed. And I just did that every day for, I don't know, however many days.
So you're like a UFC fighter trying to cut weight the day before the fight, but you did it for 13 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. It was really stupid in retrospect, but.
You lost weight for The Martian too, right?
Not really, because we shot out of order. So they hired a dancer to come in and body double me for one of those scenes. Because it was what I asked Ridley about it. I was like, if you want me to do it, we have to build the schedule around this. And he was like, no, it's actually in this new draft, it's really one scene. I can get away with it just with a body double. So I didn't have to.
What was the most weight you've had to gain in a movie?
Probably The Informant.
But
I didn't weigh myself. It was more, Steven didn't want any, how do you describe it? He didn't want any defined lines, right? He wanted the guy to, right? You can't quite put your finger on what's, you know, where the edges are of the guy. So I think it was probably about 40 pounds.
What happened with the Fritz Peterson, Mike Kekich thing?
It's sitting there. I mean, the script is pretty good actually. But no, we haven't revisited that one in a while.
So you and Ben, it's not, you guys aren't, there's nothing in the works.
We're way too old now. I mean,
no, but you're too old for that, but there's no other, anything you guys can do?
Anything we can do together? You mean?
Yes. Well, in a movie.
We've got The Last Duel coming out in October. We're both in that one. And we,
oh, that's actually coming out.
Yeah, man. It's coming out in October.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah. It's really exciting. We wrote it with Nicole Holofcener, who's just an amazing writer. So the three of us, it's basically it's about the last sanctioned duel in medieval France, fought between these two knights, one of whom claimed the other raped his wife.
Yeah.
And so we thought as a story of these different perspectives. So Ben and I wrote the male perspective and the two male perspectives, and Nicole wrote the female perspective. And Ridley Scott directed it. So we're both in that one.
How much time did you spend with him as you were putting that together? Like, dude, were you back? Was it like a mid-90s? You guys were back like every day doing the whole thing again?
What was really funny was we had anticipated this kind of grind, because when we wrote Good Will Hunting, it took us, I mean, the way we wrote it, because we didn't really know what we were doing, we wrote thousands of pages. We really understood the characters, but we didn't really understand structure. So we'd put them in different scenes. Well, what if this happened? All right. And we'd write these scenes. And then we had all these scenes and we kind of mashed them together and eventually made some kind of structure out of it. This time, like, we've both been making movies for 30 years. Like, all we've been doing is telling 2-hour stories in 3 acts. And
with,
like,
structure.
Right. And so we wrote so much faster. Like, it had kept us from writing, you know, all these years, because we were like, well, we don't have time. It's too time consuming. And now we found that we did it really fast. So now we are looking for other stuff to write together, because we had a blast. I mean, it was really fun.
You guys are back.
Yeah, man. we never left.
How many times have you found out something about him that he didn't tell you, but you found out like through the news? Like, when your best friend is somebody who's super famous, how do you know what's going on with them? Like, well, what they're telling you versus what the world is saying?
Well, I don't ever believe the news over what he would tell me. You know what I mean? Like, that, those kind of things would happen if I was working, say, in another country,
right,
and a report would come out that said Ben Affleck X, whatever. And I'd go, oh, is that happening? And then I'd just text him and be like, hey, man.
So you have to recon on it, see if it's true.
Yeah, and then he'd write back, no, that's bullshit. Or, oh, yeah, that's true. Or, here's what really happened. You know what I mean? But it's never like I read, you know, the number of times I've had to tell my, you know, I mean, I remember this, particularly when we started out, like, an entertainment story would come out about me, and like, my mother would write to me and say, like, is it true that you're, you know,
right,
you broke up with so-and-so, or you're dating so-and-so, or you're, and I'm like, mom, I don't even know that person, and don't believe anything that you read. The thing about entertainment reporting is that there aren't really any consequences.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you get the story wrong, it's just like everyone kind of goes, meh, that doesn't really matter.
You know, yeah, it just disappears.
It just goes away. And so you can kind of say anything. And oftentimes, you know, people do, or they Google something and the last thing that got reported, which it's like my wife, her husband, she was married before me, and her husband's last name is Barroso. Her ex-husband.
Yeah.
That's been her name. Like, it says Matt Damon and Luciana Barroso were together. And she's like, that's not even my name. That's been for 18 years we've been together.
Yeah.
And they haven't got that right. They've also been calling her an interior designer all that time. She's not. She never has been. But there's no, it just got put into the, it's been repeated so many times that just, when they look it up, they go, okay, here's her name and this is what she does. And they go, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, if we were in politics, that would have been corrected a long time ago, because they can't make mistakes like that. Because like, you fuck up enough things and suddenly, you know, it's kicking off in, you know, between Israel and Palestine based on being misquoted. You know what I mean? Like, there are real world consequences for misquoting somebody.
Not in celebrity culture.
No, it doesn't matter at
all. Well, your kids are old enough now to Google you, research you, all that stuff, right? How old's your oldest kid?
Well, I mean, you know, when I met Lucy, she had a 4-year-old from her first marriage, and she turned 23 yesterday.
Right.
So, So, and then 15, 12, and 10. So, yeah, they're more than old enough to kind of look up.
Yeah, I have a 16-year-old. They definitely get savvy, somewhere between 13 and 15. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, you're actually an adult who... It's really thinking about shit.
And in that regard, like, they're digital natives. So they really understand that world better than we do, and a lot quicker than we ever did.
Well, you were in Australia for at least a year, right?
Well, no, for like the first part of this year.
And then you were in France for how long? Because you'll take your family. You'll go away for like 4 to 6 months on stretches.
Yeah, if the timing works out, it's all about if it can work with their schedules. Less so now that, you know, my 15-year-old's in high school, so I won't be taking them away. But a lot of times, you know, if I can get the job over the summer, or something like The Martian, where I told Ridley well in advance that, you know, we have this 2-week rule, and so they boarded the movie so that I would go work for 2 weeks and then go back to LA and then go work for 2 weeks. And then go, you know. We make it work somehow. But no, my kids have traveled a lot, which is great. This, in fact, Stillwater was the first movie where we violated our 2-week rule. And,
really?
And it's the last one. Yeah. I mean, I won't do that again.
Do any of them want to act?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe we'll see. I mean, maybe my youngest one will be into that. They're very much into, you know, music and, you know, Taylor Swift and songwriting and that, you know what I mean? Like
Olivia Rodrigo.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And Harry Styles. And, you know, it's, but it's cool. Like, they sit around writing poetry and then tinkering around on the piano or with the guitar. Like, it's, I love it.
TikTok's the first thing that has just made me feel old. Cause it's just like, all right, so you're filming yourself. You're doing this dumb dance in 4 different locations. You add a song to it, and then it might go viral. This is how it goes. It's like, yeah, pretty much. That's what TikTok is. All right, cool. I don't know what this is.
we're old.
We really are.
We don't get it.
I'm surprised you haven't been sucked into a TikTok background appearance with one of your kids yet.
No. My daughter would be mortified. She's like,
that's good.
Nothing I can do that's cool.
What the next 10 years of your career look like? You're decade 4 now making movies, which, as we revealed earlier in the pod, what are you thinking?
I'll tell you what, the feeling that I had on this movie and on The Last Duel is the feeling, kind of creatively speaking, that I want every time. Like, it just, the feeling of, I'm just very much at peace with the work that I did, and it just feels great. It feels like, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and, you know, as you know, you get better at it.
Yeah.
And that's a really good feeling, to love your job and feel like you're getting better at it. I remember talking to this man, I don't know if I told you this story about Mike Lansing years ago when I was,
no.
I was doing the Burn Ultimatum, and there was a set visit thing, right? Like you can come visit the set, and Mike wanted, and his wife wanted to go to London. So they bought the thing, and Mike came and visited me on the set. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, Mike Lansing was kind of a journeyman second baseman, played for the Red Sox. And we were the same age, and we were walking around at Pinewood in London. And he had retired recently. And I asked him, like, the circumstances under which he retired. And he said, well, man, he goes, I was up, and the pitcher threw me a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. He goes, and my eyes lit up. He goes, because that was my bread and butter. He goes, that's how I made my living. He goes, I never was great hitting the breaking ball. But he goes, 95-mile-an-hour fastball is, you know, I'm getting a hold of that thing. Mm. And he goes, and I swung, and I was late. And he goes, and I looked down at the catcher, and the catcher looked up at me. Boom, I get another 95-mile-an-hour fastball. He goes, and I'm late again. He ends up striking out on three pitches, and he goes, it was like, you know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks before he was out of the league. Like, they just, everybody was like, it's a jungle. They were like, yeah. He can't hit it anymore. He can't, he hit that point, right? You know, he hit that cliff, right? Which is like that. It's like the wafer thin margin at that level. And what Mike said to me, which always stuck with me, was he goes, the irony is that if you took my 36-year-old brain and put it in my 21-year-old body, he goes, I would be in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
He goes, I know so much more about hitting. I understand at such a deeper level about hitting right now. And he goes, and yet I can't play anymore. And I remember thinking, like, oh my God, like, I'm 36 years old. I feel like I'm just hitting my stride, right? You know, I've been doing this as long as he's been playing baseball. Like, this is the time that gets exciting. Like, we're getting good at this now. You know what I mean? Like, and that, then how devastating it would be to just be told, you know, that's it, you know, right when you really understand it. So anyway, that always stuck with me, because we, you know, you grow up, you know, kids go, I wish I want, you know, I want to be an athlete. And you go, well, the downside of it is there's a finish line to that.
Yeah.
You know? And you're not in control of when that is. And,
yeah. Actors have like different finish lines. Cause you have your like young star finish line, and then you have your like middle star finish line. And then you kind of gravitate toward semi-older roles as you hit your 50s, I think.
Yeah. And it's different for men and women, and it depends on who you are.
Except for Cruz. Cruz will be doing Mission Impossible and he's like 88.
He's unbelievable.
Yeah.
He's unbelievable.
He's like Brady.
He's like Tom Brady. Yeah. He's the Tom Brady of actors. I was flying back from Australia, and I was just watching one of his Mission Impossibles, you know, where he hangs off the side of a plane.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, he's amazing.
What was the craziest thing you did in a movie, like athletically?
Other
than the block and school ties. I mean, crucial block and school ties. You
crucial
win the big game. You know,
Brendan Fraser just threw me in front of him.
Right.
But no, I mean, the one of the Bourne movies, I jumped off a bridge, you know, I was attached to a harness, and I mean, nothing remotely connected to. Did I ever tell you my story of having dinner with Tom Cruise?
No, please do.
Oh man, this is 10 years ago or something. And we were having dinner, and I was visiting. It was right after Krasinski and I had written Promised Land. And Emily was shooting that movie, Edge of Tomorrow, with Tom in London. Excellent movie. Doug Liman movie.
Yeah,
really good.
Great one.
And we went over there, and we all went out to dinner, and it was right after Tom had done the skit where he, or the scene where he ran outside the building on that, in that Mission Impossible. Remember the one where he runs sideways around the tallest building in the world? So I go, let me, like, dude, what happened? Like, how did that come to pass? And he goes, well, I mean, I've been dreaming of that stunt for 15 years. And he starts to tell me the story. He goes, so I go to the safety guy, And I go, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to attach myself, you know, to a cable, and I'm going to run. I'm going to run around the outside of the building, about 1,500 feet up or whatever it was. And he goes, safety guy, looks at the gag. He goes, no, no, it's too dangerous. So I get a new safety guy. Wait a minute, stop. Hang on. That's how your mind works. Like, the safety guy says it's too dangerous, so we get another safety guy. I'm like, that's where I'm like, see, you win. I tap out right there. When the safety guy says it's too dangerous, I'm like, well, he probably knows because he's
you're a one opinion guy.
Yeah, exactly. I only need to hear that once. But he's just built differently, you know? And I mean, he really is at this point, you know, one of the great stuntmen in the world. I mean,
right.
You know, you get, when you look at the stuff that he's done, it's incredible.
Have you thought about like other A-list actors over the years and how their career progressed? Like even in the old days, like the Newman Redford guys, and studied like the choices they made as they got older?
Not really. Not, I haven't really gone deep in that. I mean, I always just think if you make good movies, you keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and that's it. And it doesn't have to be any more complicated. It's just really hard to make good movies.
Well, so that involves attaching yourself to the next generation of filmmakers, which you just did a couple times.
It's a collaborative medium, right? So you got to find great people to work with. And the more great people you're working with, the better chance you're going to make a good movie.
Or Ridley Scott, who's like 85 and could still crank out movies for some reason. He's another one. I don't understand him either. Isn't he like legitimately 80?
He's 83.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He'll be 84 in November. No.
It's impressive.
He's going to make three. He did our movie, which is a big budget medieval movie. And then he did Gucci, which is another big budget movie. And in the fall, he's doing this Napoleon movie for either Netflix or Apple. I can't remember, but it's twice the budget of the other two massive movies he already made during a pandemic. No, it's ridiculous. It's like, he's completely like indefatigable. The guy,
I don't get it. All my parents are over 70, and most of my relationship with them now is just explaining why whatever technology they have isn't working and how to fix it. Like, right. Well, no, just reboot the Wi-Fi router. It should work. Right. Or they probably changed your Netflix password. Just put the one in from the last time. That's like 90% of my conversations.
Yeah. No, look, I've seen it with Clint too. Like, Clint's 91 and he's still working.
Clint's 91?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I worked with him when he was 79. That was in 2009. Yeah. And look, it's great for somebody who loves this job to see somebody doing it that well at that age, right? I mean, watching Ridley, it's so fun watching him direct. Again, that's where it's not athletics, right?
Right.
There doesn't have to be a cliff.
Yeah.
If you're still bringing it, you can still do the job.
Well, you have a couple that you haven't worked with yet, right? Have you? You have not worked with Fincher.
No.
And you have not worked with PTA either, right?
No. I would love to work with either of those guys. I do the phone book with either of those guys.
Because Ben worked with Fincher.
Yeah, loves him. Absolutely loves him. Yeah. Fincher's tough because I went to watch him shoot one day. Fincher's, he's got that Kubrick kind of gift and curse, which is he can't unsee what he sees, which is why his movies are so great.
That was a good one.
I mean, and then what's really incredible about David is the performances in his movies are great too, which sometimes when somebody is doing that many takes, the performances can really suffer. And for some reason they don't in David's. Like, part of his genius is understanding what great acting is on top of his kind of visual genius.
Yeah, Gone Girl, which is a movie that, because everybody knows the book. It's always hard when they make the movie out of the book.
Yeah.
People kind of know what's going to happen, but they could still make it interesting. I always respect that. By the way, I thought I was on the Affleck corner for Oscars last year with the
Wellback.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he wasn't even in the conversation. And I was like, all right, well, he's... I sound like a homer. I sound like I'm defending like Jason Tatum for second team RB or something. But I was like, this is one of the best performances I saw all year. And he wasn't even mentioned. I never understand the Oscar thing. Like, why some people get momentum and other people don't. But I thought he was really good in that movie.
I thought he was great. And that's all you can do is just be great in a movie and, you know, do the best job you can. And because you never know if you're going to catch that wave. That's all. That's down to a bunch of other stuff. I think you just keep, he's just doing great work. You should see him in The Last Duel. He's amazing in The Last Duel. It's a supporting part and he's just so good. It's one of the best things I think he's ever done. But you never know if that kind of conversation is going to break your way. You know, I've always thought that they should do those awards like 10 or 20 years later. Like when you remove all of the kind of campaigning and money and marketing dollars out, right? And just go, what's still here? Like, we know what's good. If we were doing, what would this year be? 2001, right? I can't remember what came out in 2001, yeah. But like we could see what got nominated and we could see what else came out that year. And we'd probably have a different list.
I always used to say 5-year Oscars, where it's just wait 5 years. Cause in sports, you know, right away, you do the MVP, you have a sense,
sure,
you know?
Sure.
But I think in movies, you really have to get some distance. This is something on the Rewatchables pod we do. We're always like amazed by, like we did Boys in the Hood last month. And it's like Fishburne didn't get nominated.
I know.
And you go through the five supporting actors. And you're like, what the fuck?
And you're like, what the hell?
How did he not get nominated? And then the movie didn't get nominated either. I mean, they only had five back then, but Singleton did get nominated. But just in general,
that's the odd thing about that is that it's not that people didn't see that movie. I remember that movie being a phenomenon when it came out.
It was.
So I don't know why Fish didn't get nominated. That's crazy.
Yeah, there's some egregious ones in the 89 to 94 range. And then I think because Premiere Magazine was there was different people writing about it. So at least they got a little better, but it was still pretty bad all the way through, really. For the most part, there's always like travesties, right?
Sure.
But stuff like that, when you go back or like Spike doesn't get nominated for Do the Right Thing and things like that.
Did he not get nominated for Do the Right Thing? You're kidding me. That's
Singleton
silly.
Was the first Black director ever nominated.
No way.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some really bad ones when you go way back. It's gotten better recently.
No, but I think you're 5-year. I would even double down and say 10-year. I think that would solve a lot of that. It would certainly make the travesty part go away.
Well, because we were doing Fight Club. Brad Pitt did not get nominated in Fight Club. Neither did Fincher. And Fight Club got bad reviews when it came out in certain circles. It was very polarizing. And then... 10 years later, people appreciated it. But like Cider House Rules is all over the map in the Oscars for the 1999 year. And it's like Michael Caine wins. It's multiple.
Well, Cider House Rules and Talented Mr. Ripley did not get a Best Picture nomination.
Right. Jude Law was, I think, the only one, right? And you didn't get one.
No. Jude Law and I think the screenplay. But it was Cider House Rules was because Ripley was Miramax and Paramount.
Yeah.
And Cider House was Miramax. And Cider House got in. I remember that.
Well, there was definitely, and I think it was because who was voting, but every year you can see it. There's always like, let's give this one to the old guy. Let's give this one to the old lady. Let's give this one to the old movie. Like that movie was always taken care of. So there's always like only 80% of the pot. Now we don't do that. Now it's, I think people are so afraid of backlash if they screw up on the votes or if the wrong things happen. It does seem like we're gravitating toward a better selection, I would say.
Hopefully.
Because the MVP is like that too in NBA, where it's like we're just getting better at it versus you go back 30 years ago and people are like, vote for Kevin McHale. You know, because I work for the Patriot Ledger. He seems nice to me yesterday. I'm voting for MVP. Those days seem like they're over.
I hope so. I mean, I wish they took all the campaigning out of it. Like that always struck me as insane. Like why does your going to a cocktail party or showing up for a brunch change the way someone's going to vote for your performance? The two have nothing to do with one another.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? It was just always odd.
Yeah. How do you campaign for art?
No, exactly. It's like, it doesn't make sense to me because it shouldn't, if I'm voting for that, it's not going to be because I met you and you talked to me. And I mean, it shouldn't be because I like you. It should be because I that work was really, you know, something that I want to, like, you know, be a part of giving you an award for, because I thought you were awesome.
Well, screeners, I think, have changed a little too, just because I think the movie you just made is a really good example. I would have rather have seen that in the theater. It's like big sprawling. There's cool. I'm in Oklahoma. I'm in Marseille. Yeah. Like, I get to go to all these different places and there's a pace to it. And, you know, when you're screening something, I never feel like I have 100. I'm like maybe 95% attention, but there's always that 5% when you're trapped in a theater where you're just locked in on the movie the whole time. You
totally.
Know?
Well, going to the theater is more like, you know, church. There's yeah. more, like, you show up when it starts. Like, you're not, you know, and I really worry about that in terms of the viewing habits of, like, my kids and this next generation. Like,
yeah.
You know, they control the movie. You know what I mean? They've got a remote control. They can stop it and start it. They are just kind of acculturated to kind of like, I kind of feel like I'm going to go make some popcorn, or I'm going to go to the bathroom right now. I'm going to stop it. Whereas when we grew, it was like, that thing is going to play. It's playing at 2:15 and you got to sit there, and and it's not going to be over till 4:20.
And if you have to get up, you got to make six people move.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And that's a very different relationship to the thing you're watching. It's a much more respectful relationship. Like, you're really giving the art, the movie its due. You're really paying attention.
Yeah. And that's why I think with, like, the prestige TV stuff, that's one of the reasons people are gravitating to it. Right. Cause like these, like, I'm watching White Lotus right now, which I like, on HBO. It's like 1 hour a week. I'm with these people. I'll concentrate. They have 94% of my attention. Then I get to move on. I don't have to, like, go to a movie theater, sit down. I'm not trapped in the seat, because we're used to having all these options now. But I kind of miss the days of being trapped in the seat. And yeah, I'm so with you. I think about it with my kids. Like, you know, I want them to concentrate when they watch stuff. And I'm always worried about their 100% attention.
So am I. Yeah. I notice it with my kids, like, just talking during, you know, we were watching, like we love the show Alone. I don't know if you've seen Alone on Netflix.
Who's in it?
Oh, no one. It's survivalists. It's they take real survivalists and they put them in these survival situations. They have like 10 contestants and they have to live alone by themselves. It's amazing, man. It's just amazing. They film themselves and it's just, you know, they have to survive for 90 days. And what's incredible is, I mean, I think they're like 10 seasons into this thing, and like, it's almost impossible to survive 90 days on your own in a hostile environment.
Yeah.
And these are like SEER specialists. And like, I mean, every hardcore survivalist goes on there. And anyway, it's a really fun show to watch. But like most TV with my kids, like my 10-year-old will just start talking. And I'm like, no.
You know, yeah, quiet.
Right now. Like, and I think that has to do with being in total control of the thing you're watching. Like, you can just pause at any time. You can just, you know what I mean? It's kind of there to serve you rather than you being there to serve it, figure out what it is.
So you said, you just gave an interview. You said you wouldn't let your daughter watch Good Will Hunting.
No, she doesn't want to. I would totally let her watch it. She does. She literally doesn't want. She does. She's like, thinks it's funny. I think she loves giving me shit, and she's like, she won't watch anything she thinks I might be good in. So
she doesn't want you to win her over.
Right. I don't know what it is. It's like, it's whatever it is. She's in control of it and it's fun and it makes me laugh and she's fine with it. Like she calls that movie The Great Wall. I did The Wall. And I'm like, it's not called The Wall. It's called The Great Wall. And she's like, Dad, there's nothing great about that movie.
So she's like, definitely Masshole DNA.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah. Yeah. She wasn't born there, but like, she's got
it transferred. Cause my son has lived in LA his whole life, but is like just a prototypical Masshole. And I'm like, I don't know how this happened.
It's genetic.
Yeah.
It's
genetic. It might be.
But really funny. And, you know,
she didn't see The Martian. So she won't watch that one either.
She did see The Martian because her friend saw it. She was like 10 when The Martian came out. So I thought she was way too young. And then when I was at school, like doing the drop-offs and pickups, like the other parents and other kids were coming up and they, and her classmates had seen it. So I was like, okay, well, so I thought it was a little too advanced for her, but I sat and watched it with her. I got a DVD and sat and watched it with her. And you know, there's a part where like I get an antenna in my stomach at the beginning, you know, so the kids wanted to see it. I showed them that. I was like, dude, that's a prosthetic stomach. I'd like pause the movie and like lift up my shirt and go, they built this whole piece over here. And, you know, try to walk them through it so they weren't traumatized seeing their dad like sewing it. But no, so she did see that one. So I think she concedes that occasionally I can make a good movie, and she's not interested in seeing any more of them. She's interested, if she hears it's a disaster, she wants to see it.
That one, that's a perfectly rewatchable movie. That one, 30 years from now, it'll be the same experience for her as ever watching it.
I hope so, man. I'm proud of it.
Those outer space movies, like that could easily come out 30 years from now and hit a lot of the same beats, I feel like.
I hope so, man.
Assuming we're all still here. Who knows?
It's so hard to make a good movie, man. I always tell, like I say to my 15-year-old, I'm like, you know, we don't get to see the movie before it's made. You know, like you're kind of betting on these ingredients. And, you know, like take The Great Wall. I mean, that director, his name's Zhang Yimou. He's like one of the most brilliant directors in the world. And I love the man. And I would work for him again if I hope he calls me again for a job.
Yeah.
Because he's great. But for whatever reason, The Alchemy it just didn't happen on that one, you know, and it wasn't anybody's fault. It was just the attendant pieces didn't kind of cohere. And it's like you make a souffle, but it doesn't rise. You know what I mean? You had great ingredients, but just didn't quite happen.
Is that your number one? I don't understand why that didn't come together movie, or is there another one?
No. I don't understand why it didn't come together.
Like I don't understand why this didn't hit the way I thought it was going to hit movie.
No, I would say that my number one didn't hit like I thought it would hit. I mean, Downsizing, just because it was Alexander.
Oh, yeah. Payne. We talked about that the last time. Yeah, you made a good case for that. But after we talked about that, there's a Downsizing hive that I think next 5 years is going to be interesting with that movie. I think it's coming around. Yeah, I do.
I don't know. I heard a radio guy one day. I was coming home from dropping the kids at school. And as I pulled in, this guy starts, I forget which disc jockey, he's like, man, I just saw the worst movie I've seen in a really long time. And he starts to watch it. And I pull the car over, because when I go into my garage, I lose the signal. And I'm like, shit, I bet he's going to be talking about my movie. And I pull the car over. Like I had to see it through. I had to hear the whole rant. And this dude went on like a 5-minute rant about how bad this movie that he saw was. And then he goes, and then of course it was Downsizing. And I remember thinking, why would you hate this so much? But some movies are polarizing, like, you know, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Here's a good story for you that Scorsese told me when we were making The Departed. He told me a story about when he made I brought up The King of Comedy, which is one of my favorites of his.
That's an all-time most polarizing movie.
Right. And he goes, the first story that jumped to mind for him was it was New Year's Eve. And he goes, I was putting on a tuxedo. I was going out to a New Year's Eve party. It was a black tie party. And he goes, and I was trying to tie my bow tie in the mirror. And the television was on, and back then it's, you know, three channels, obviously. And whatever channel he's on, the entertainment reporter goes, and the competition for the worst movie of the year is over. The King of Comedy, you know, and Marty said he just tied his bow tie, and he sat and he just looked at himself in the mirror and then untied the bow tie, took the jacket off, like just that was it. He wasn't going anywhere. He went and he just crawled into and went to sleep, you know, and that movie's brilliant. Right. And it's one of his great movies, but you know, sometimes, you know, you can get laid low by these things.
Well, when he did Departed, it's interesting because we did a whole podcast on Goodfellas and we were trying to figure out that movie's
perfect.
Yeah. We went 2.5 hours, and I think it was the most listened rewatchables we've had everybody loves that movie.
Everybody loves that movie. I think that's his best.
So we were arguing about, because there's this category of Apex Mountain where it's like, is this your apex where you have the most juice, all this stuff? And we were like, definitely his best movie that he's ever made. But I do feel like Departed, career-wise, after Departed, it felt like it was the first time in his career where he could literally do anything he wanted. Like he ascended to some higher juice power. You know what I mean?
maybe within the business, but I don't know. Like every time he was doing, I mean, he does Mean Streets and then he does Taxi Driver. I mean, my God, right? And then Raging Bull. I mean, it's just, he's just on such a tear, like in that time frame. And then it's like, what could he possibly do? And he does Goodfellas. And you're like,
that movie's aged perfectly, because the first time, I remember the first time I saw it, the last 20 minutes, which he's intentionally trying to fuck with you, right? And you leave the theater, you're like, well, I don't know about those last 20 minutes. But then you see it the fifth time, you're like, oh, I get it.
It's so damn good. But yeah, Departed, I don't know. I think maybe because common perception kind of caught up with his genius by that point.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
He's so kind of accepted as, you know, that the Departed, I'm very proud to have been in that movie, but it's not one of Marty's best movies, but there was no way he was going to not win, be anointed the best director by the Academy. It was cheapening the award at that point that he didn't have one.
Yeah.
Right? It was like doing more damage to the Academy than it was doing to Marty, because it's so absurd that he didn't, after what he had given to cinema, to American cinema, he didn't have this.
Oh, that's, speaking of Oscar travesties. So he loses for Goodfellas.
Yes.
Costner wins for Dances with Wolves. Costner, great guy. But I think in retrospect, we might do that one over.
Look, you never, but the people who win, it's like, you don't punish them for making a good movie. You know what I mean? It's not their fault that they were also nominated that year, that, you know, and they're not the ones who, it's thousands of people doing this voting. So it's not, it's always weird to me when people kind of like take out their disappointment on the person who did win.
Yeah.
Right? You're like, well, all that happened was they made a movie and somebody gave them an award and they showed up and got it. Like, you know, your disappointment's a little misplaced.
Well, the two travesties that were underrated, because everyone remembers the Scorsese thing, De Niro did not get nominated for that movie.
Oh, wow. See, but again, that's something that, like, that's the other thing. Like,
and neither did Leota.
Yeah, wow. I mean,
think about that.
Well, and that's why, like, because if you told me that they both did, I would say today, and I love that movie, and I work in Hollywood, I would be like, well, of course they did. They both deserve to.
Yeah.
You know, there's just no question that 30 years later, that movie is what it is. It's like, it's so, that's why it's not worth getting twisted and bent out of shape about the nominations, because nobody's going to remember, you know, if somebody backed into a nomination by campaigning really well and like Ray Liotta didn't get nominated. It's not like in 30 years, that's going to mean anything. Going to mean the Academy got it wrong.
I think Stillwater is going to be a little polarizing. I was into it. I liked it. But I think there's going to be some people that are going to be like, fuck this movie.
Yeah. I mean, it's not what you think it's going to be. Right. I hope, you know, I would want them to sell it as a drama, because that's what it is. It's a drama. You know, it's got elements of a thriller in it. But those elements are going to make it look more like a Liam Neeson movie. And we fail entirely on the grounds of it being a satisfying action movie, because it's not. It's about a guy who doesn't have any of the requisite skills he would need to do what he wants to do. He's completely overmatched by the situation. He doesn't understand what's going on around him. He doesn't speak the language. He doesn't understand the culture. And he's just trying to repair this relationship with his daughter that he's done terrible damage to over the years because of his own problems. And so it's very much a drama to me. And I always approached it that way. Like, but yeah, if it's sold as like an action movie, and, you know, then no, it will be polarized. It should be polarizing, because it's not that at all.
The little girl in the movie is really good.
She's great.
And ironically, the girl who plays your daughter in the movie had a great little girl performance in Little Miss Sunshine and is now grown up. And it was like totally disorienting.
Yeah,
it's like, oh my God, she's an adult now. What the hell happened?
She's a real actress.
Yeah, you know? She's good too.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the little girl had never acted before. And
she's really good.
She's amazing. She's one of those kids, like, sometimes you just get lightning in a bottle with a kid. Like, after the first day of work, Tom and I sat down and we're like, okay, like, this, I mean, we literally said, you'll appreciate the reference. We were like, because I've been trying to explain it in Europe. It takes a minute. And like, this kid's throwing a no hitter.
Right.
Like, after day one, we're like, you know, she basically struck out the side in the first inning, and we're like, all right, this isn't a fluke. Like she's incredible. So how do we protect her? How do we keep it fun, you know, and keep it really playful and fun and light for her so the last thing you want is for her to realize she's like, you know, pitching a perfect game. And so we were able to do that. And the French laws were really helpful because they have these kind of draconian laws around child labor, which is a good thing because we only had her for a few hours a day. So when she was there, she was eight years old. And, you know, everybody was very focused and we made sure to get everything we needed with her and we kept it really fun and light. And she never got burned out. She had a really good time.
So you have, this is out. Last Duel is coming October. I wonder if that's a movie theater movie or a hybrid movie. Who knows what the world's going to be like with this stuff in October. And then,
yeah, hopefully it's a big movie theater movie.
And then what's next? What's after that?
I don't have anything. We're moving to Brooklyn. So it's a big move for the family. So I'm going to take the rest of the year off and just be there to kind of be around. We just want to be around for, you know, as we make that transition. And then next year I'll just look and, you know, maybe Ben and I will write something, or if something comes along, if some of those great directors you mentioned, you know, have something.
Big Little Lies season 4 in Nantucket. You got that? Exactly. Got that in your hip pocket? Wait.
I was thinking Fincher or PTA, but
either. Wait, you can't, I'm worried about your family in New York. You just monitor the New York sports thing, because we don't like any of the New York sports teams. So just be,
we don't like any of them.
Just be careful. Well, just monitor it with the younger kids, especially.
I might have to go to a couple Brooklyn games. That's a fun team to watch play.
All right. Just make sure your kids aren't wearing the hats or anything.
No, I wouldn't let that happen.
Yeah. All right. Good to see you, Matt Damon.
Yeah, you too.
Pleasure as always.